Don't You Change the Dial. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz calling you at 96.3 FM. Today, July 2nd, 2000, it's 2.5 hours coming at you of Bathrobe Spears Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor here in Santa Cruz. We're hoping to do a little phone talk on AB 1800, the lock 'em up and throw away the key psychiatric blank check for the shrinks and police who think that folks should, spend a little more time on the psych wards. We think perhaps the politicians spend a little more time, at least out of power. Stay with us. Again, welcome to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, the twice-weekly show that deals with the rights that most folks take for granted, but that those outside often don't have, such as the right to sleep, the right to find a place to go to the bathroom without being harassed by police. Poor folks find it difficult to exchange goods, such as to exchange their jewelry for coffee money or for small amounts of money to make repairs on their cars or to make a living in some way, unless they're a part of the tourist machine here in Santa Cruz, the real estate speculation market, the over-the-hill Silicon rat race, you name it. What we concern ourselves with are the rights that should be available to folks in our city and that are not. And that's what I focus on. I'm your host, Robert Norris, also known as Bathrobe Spear Robert for the scantily seen bathrobe that I wear to protests around the sleeping ban, which has been a kind of a key theme on this show for the last 5 years. The sleeping ban, the law that makes it illegal for homeless people, anyone in fact, who's outside to sleep in a vehicle or on public property at pain of a $54 fine, a midnight wake-up, a threat of a vehicle tow, and harassment of different kinds, of course, from private people, such as beatings, just get out of here, abusive language, wake up and leave kinds of comments and so forth, which have become apparently increasingly frequent now that the trollbusters, or the NIMBYs, not in my backyard people, have been inspired by a city council that has surrendered to the police department, appears to be, a police department and a small segment of the business community, in a kind of a colluded effort to kill the safe sleeping zones that we saw voted for a first reading on May 23rd, ignored on June 13th by the City Council, and then in a very late night action by Councilmember Catherine Byers, voted down 4-3. She changed her vote on June 27th, last Tuesday, actually Wednesday morning, at about 1 or 1:15 in the morning. I began to discuss that last show, and I didn't really get to the conclusion of it, including my arrest by Santa Cruz police officers. Actually, I was evicted from council chambers by the mayor, ID'd by the police, just so they want to make sure they had the right guy there. And then four police officers wanted to know if the mayor wanted me taken into custody. He decided against it. In fact, he decided against citing me, but I was, in fact, technically arrested and forced to leave a public meeting. And we're going to go into that. Actually, the long and the short of it, since I talked about it, but I continue to tease people by not telling them the details, and very few know because it wasn't in the paper, and it was you had to have been up there at watching community television if you had it at 1:15 or 1:30 to see what happened. Briefly, I may have mentioned it before, but briefly what happened was I spoke at the mic on an item, the killing of the sleeping zones. I was one of, I guess, three people who spoke, myself, Becky Johnson, and Lydia Blanchard, were the only people in the audience other than Scott Graham, who weathered that long, long process. I was kind of bitter briefly, thinking that there were no living wage people there, no medical marijuana people there, But activist Bernard Klitzner pointed out to me that it hadn't been announced, although it was on the agenda. Anybody who wanted to see sleeping ban stuff coming up could have seen it. It was printed on the agenda. People didn't choose to read it. We didn't publicize it because it was a last-minute item that came up, which Christopher Krohn put on the agenda, I think, on Friday, and it only came out on the revised agenda on Monday. Although I guess you could get a fax of it if you have a fax machine or if you'd gone into the office to look for it. And the item was not actually to vote on the safe sleeping zones, but to postpone them until July 11th. Now, Catherine Byers didn't want to do that. She wanted to dump and bury the whole thing, as if homeless people and their rights could be buried so quickly. And indeed, she moved to do it, and they did it on a 4-3 vote. I'll be discussing that vote as well as the other items that came up at that late night hour, all of them brought up by Krohn, Councilmember Krohn. But again, what happened with the arrest was I spoke at the mic and was repeatedly interrupted by Mayor Sugar. Some of you who have been attending council meetings may be aware that Sugar has been increasingly doing this, which I believe violates the public participation provisions of the Brown Act, the state law regulating how meetings should be conducted. And again, I'm not a lawyer, and frankly, I haven't examined the Brown Act very carefully. I'm just saying this from just based on my general sense of what it mandates, and I could be wrong here. It could be okay for the mayor to interrupt whenever he wants for whatever reason he wants. I would certainly hope not. Anyway, Sugar did this to me. I ignored it, finished my speech. Video journalist Becky Johnson began to speak. She spoke. He did the same thing to her. I stood off to the side and said, in an audible but not disruptive voice, "Please stop interrupting the speaker, Mayor Sugar." Sugar said, "Leave the chambers." I said, "No." He called the police, ordered a warrant, sworn out, criminal complaint, he said, and then declared I would not be allowed in at the next council meeting, which presumably was on Thursday. That was the next council meeting. I wrote him a letter afterwards saying that I'm not coming to that council meeting in order to, even though I would like to have come, in order to obey his dictate, but that I expect not to be harassed at future council meetings, and I would like to also mediate these issues with him, because it's not so much I'm sure it's personality as well, but I want to make sure that he allows certain kinds of oral contact with the public. I mean, he certainly was elected on this open process back in 1998. We have a call coming in, and let's see what the public has to say.
I just was listening to what you were saying about the Brown Act, and I'm pretty sure that you have an amount of time to speak whatever you need to speak, and that it wouldn't be, it doesn't really have so much to do with the Brown Act as it does with parliamentary procedure. Mm-hmm. For him to interrupt you, that's totally not right. Mm-hmm. But with the Brown Act, what concerned me that you were saying that does violate the Brown Act is if they made an agenda and then used an agenda that was different than the agenda that they posted, unless they posted the revised agenda within 72 hours of the meeting, it has to be posted, then they couldn't even use the agenda. And I know that this city council often violates the Brown Act.
Now, can you call her, well, regarding what you're saying, and I'm very interested in hearing some of the history you've had with the city council, you're watching them or getting involved with them. I have to clarify, and I want to give them due credit. They did post the revised agenda, which had the Krohn sleeping ban item at the, I think it was the end of the day, Friday. So I think they got in under the 72 hours.
Okay.
And so that was done. The significance was that it was not picked up by any of the media, and that it also, the item of Krohn's item was to have the sleeping ban issue brought up on the 11th, the safe sleeping zones issue brought up on the 11th. What Byers did was she moved to have it immediately voted withdrawn from publication, as she put it, which meant killed the entire safe sleeping zone proposal. But tell me more about what you found observing the city council. Are you a longtime Santa Cruzan?
Actually, I'm not, and I'm going to UCSC, and I went to one of their meetings to I wanted to observe, mm-hmm. and I wanted to see how they displayed their power, mm-hmm. in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I really was disappointed in how abusive Keith Sugar is with his position as facilitator of meetings and also as mayor, as the facilitator of meetings, he often dominates and he often cuts people off and he often argues as people are trying to make points.
How many meetings of his have you been to?
I actually only went to the one meeting.
Which meeting was that?
But I've also observed him on the television. And the meeting that I went to was about Terrace Point.
Mm-hmm. And how many of you meetings have you watched on television where you've seen Keith Sugar in action?
Well, where I've actually watched Keith Sugar, I'd say about three.
Mm-hmm.
But I've watched many more meetings prior, like when they were doing the decision about the Beach Flats area.
Uh-huh.
I was watching a lot then, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
That's pretty much all the experience I've had with the city council. I know that I can't call him a real good friend of mine, but someone that I admire in the community, Steve Argue, is actually running for city council.
That's true.
So that's someone I'm thinking I'm going to be voting for.
Mm-hmm. I think Argue will be better than anybody in the council now. And there are a number of other people running. I think more important than anybody who's going to win or not win, since I think the council process is a way of corrupting almost whoever wins. I think Steve would have
almost a
good shot at not being corrupted.
Oh, yes. He's been in the jail here, so.
Definitely. Seven months in jail.
I don't think they can corrupt him.
Yeah.
At this point, he's filthy.
But I think as important as that is to have community organizing going on that forces council members to pay attention even when they're in the grip of the new. They're kind of, the blinkers are put on them by the staff members around them. They're afraid to try to fire the old staff, which is what they should have done, of course, 2 years ago.
Right.
They should have had a new police chief, a new city attorney, and a new city manager. But that, of course, issue has been verboten. They don't want to talk about that one.
Right.
And that's a pity. You know, actually, I have a Scan Insider. Scan, of course, is Santa Cruz Action Network. And I'm telling, you probably know about this, but for those who don't, that's the organization that elected virtually all these council members and has been running. Unfortunately, they claimed they had a much more progressive direction, not just the council, but SCAN, and they were kind of to hold council members accountable. But, of course, SCAN didn't have a word to say about the beach area, about the beach flats. I call it the Dolphin Lee Demolition Plan until very, very recently when they were forced to because...
Sorry.
Uh-oh. Sounds like a baby to me, man.
It's a baby.
Is this one of those community activists who's actually been responsible for getting new forums going? Do I recognize that baby?
Oh, you may. Yes, I guess that could be me.
Excellent, excellent. Listen, is there more you want to say before we continue?
Well, I'm really enjoying your show, and I wanted to also quickly mention that the reason that I say that I am sure that this city council often violates the Brown Act is because I have been and heard of meetings that they, like, just bring up stuff that isn't even on the agenda at all
mm-hmm.
to talk about.
To get specifics
on
that.
And one of the things is a lot of this, the sleeping ban stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't give the opportunity, they don't give everyone the opportunity, they don't give people, us, the opportunity to know that they're going to be discussing this issue, and then they discuss it without even us knowing that they're going to be discussing it, so we don't know what they're saying.
Right, and I have to take some responsibility for not getting the message out to the public, because what was on the agenda was to postpone the issue until July 11th,
mm.
and it also was at the end of the agenda, actually it was at the end of the afternoon agenda, which was put eventually to the end of the evening agenda, although that might have been, you know, expected. Had I gotten the information out, we might have had more people. In fact, we probably would have, because there are medical marijuana and living wage people there in numbers, and I think that we gave them, the living wage and medical marijuana people, the floor in the middle of the March and April protests against the sleeping ban at City Council, and I would have hoped that they would have responded by doing the same to us, and perhaps they would have had they known more clearly. Although I was giving out flyers about the issue, it wasn't clear when the issue was going to come up, and I hate to have people have to wait till 1:15 in the morning. I suppose we could have pressed the City Council to put off the issue until July 11th.
Right.
The problem is we were divided because the City Council wasn't doing anything about the porta potties and the dumpsters, which is what we wanted also, which I'm going to talk about on the air.
Okay.
So call back if you'd like.
Thank you.
And thank
you're
you
doing
for
a great
calling.
Job.
Hey, thanks.
Bye.
Well, let's keep those complimentary calls coming. Free Radio Santa Cruz is 96.3 FM. That's what you're tuned to. Talking about the last City Council meeting on June 27th, and in the wee hours on the 28th is when they killed the safe sleeping zones. I'm also talking about violations of the Brown Act, which I believe I'm going to have to go into much more seriously, methodically, and perhaps in a judicial context. in the months ahead, because I don't see Mayor Sugar or his council, and his council is also responsible. Sugar may be a loose cannon of a sort, but unless he's held in check by his council and that great parliamentarian Michael Rotkin, there is, you know, they're all of them are responsible for Brown Act violations. So the most frequent Brown Act violation I've seen, and it's a Brown Act violation, there's just no question about it, is Sugar's refusal or neglect around public comment on agendized items. So, for example, if there's an item up on this appropriation or that appropriation, he has a responsibility to ask if there's any public comment on the item. He has repeatedly not done this, and I mean, this is documented on, over a number of sessions. I've had to stand up and say, public comment. At different times he said, sit down, be quiet, meaning I don't want to hear you remind me that I have certain rights and responsibilities to the public. He has he violated the Brown Act in another case, which involved the Citizens Police Review Board. The Citizens Police Review Board, of course, has been an ineffective joke for almost all of its, well, all of its existence. We had hopes early on, but they were false hopes. And the new city council, new as of 2 years ago, now the old city council, were supposed to appoint people who would actually do something on the board. Instead, they appointed people who lost their heart very early. Arnold left, Becky Blythe, and Sandy Brown, for different reasons. Sandy Brown has never had enough time to do anything, and she hasn't acknowledged that, but she stayed on the board. Becky Blythe likes to do patty cake with the police and has never effectively challenged them on anything that I'm aware of. That may be an exaggeration, but it's close enough for government work. And Arnold Leff is the worst of the group. He's the new chair, and he has repeatedly put off any kind of discussion of changing the law or challenging this most recent fiasco, the $10,000 independent investigation that suddenly closed shut as tight as a drum and censored before it starts. That's into the matter, which involves the Steve Argue, the police abuse against Argue and other protesters at the May 22nd rally a year ago at the Yugoslavian question around the bombing of Yugoslavia at the Democratic fundraiser on Front Street, down at Front and Cooper Street. And what happened there was, reportedly, although I don't know because I'm not allowed to see that report, I've heard that there's a lot of criticism of police behavior, that Officer Lefebvre has, the individual who reportedly, by Steve Argue's account, pepper sprayed him in the mouth, down the throat, assaulted him, and also, of course, went after a woman and child in a very unprofessional manner, and the whole crowd control scene was extremely unprofessional by police. He's moved on to another city, so the other police agencies and other communities get inflicted with him, of course, without no doubt any warning or discussion. And you know, there's probably no public process in those communities either, since police seem to rule in the United States and probably in other countries as well. Just the way it goes. It serves the interests of those who run the scene, I guess. At least I would hope that it's not the majority desire for police to be able to have the kind of discretion they do throughout the country and throughout the world. Anyway, the Brown Act violations that happened were concerning an attempt to get this ordinance some teeth put into the Citizens Police Review Board. And the Ordinance Committee under Arnie Leff just didn't meet for 6 months. And we kept arguing about that. Then he set up a special subcommittee to meet with the city council. They had a meeting, and they tried to close it to the public. I went in there and said, this is a Brown Act violation, you can't. Their own attorney said, no, you can do it, it's not a Brown Act violation. But the guy they hired from out of town for another $10,000, Bob Aronson from Palo Alto, an attorney, said it is a Brown Act violation. And so since that time, in February or March, they've held no further meetings of this committee. They prefer not to meet in public.
You're probably out of range, and you haven't been hearing my fine speech about Brown Act violations.
Yeah, those private meetings are the ones, aren't they?
Well, yeah, they are, and of course, then they're the court proceedings are what follow them, or
yeah,
what go on at the same time. I assume that's what you're calling about, activist.
Well, we're gonna see one coming up here in a couple, 3 weeks, and that's going to be an interesting one, because it'll be the result of a meeting that took place back in 97 between our illustrious Sheriff Mark Tracy and the merchants down at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center.
Really? You know, you've been following probably more closely than I, although I've been getting the proceedings recorded thanks to the unusual liberality of Judge Bill Kelsey in this case, the Jerry Henry trial, which has just ended. The jury has come back. You want to give us an update on that?
Well, I can tell you what I know.
Okay.
From what I understand of what happened.
Well, first of all, tell us what Jerry was charged with and so forth.
Well, they had a myriad of charges. They had disturbing the peace charges and trespassing charges in a public place, which is always an amusement to me.
And a public nuisance charge.
And, well, that was the one, that was the big one. What they did was, in order to gather together everything that they had not prosecuted him for before, had threatened to, and went all the way to the day of trial and then backed off, in order to incorporate that all in and give them a better shot at demonizing him, they backed up like 4 years or something, and then and this public nuisance charge, which is one that everybody should have just been absolutely quaking in their boots about, because that is the first step to the concentration camps, gas chambers, ovens, the whole movie.
It's interesting that that charge has not been used before in a criminal context. In fact, the judge and the public defender had difficulty finding any jury instructions for it because it's not normally used in criminal proceedings, right?
No, it's never used. It's never been done against a man. It's been done against
A toxic waste dump?
Well, toxic waste dumps and factories that, you know, that move into an area and so on, and gangs where they come in and they start shooting one another and all that kind of stuff. It's been used that way against human beings, but never a single individual. And you start thinking about the ramifications. Can you find a group of people that can be offended by an individual? And if you can, that would serve as the basis for a public nuisance trial. And I don't know what kind of sentencing could come down.
It's a misdemeanor.
Ultimately, it's a setup for a Nazi fascist police state.
Well, I know that the group of individuals that complained about Jerry Henry were a kind of a motley coalition of security guards, sheriff's deputies, and merchants out at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center, well assisted by, I think, thoroughly compromised judicial officers who held him on a $100,000 bail. By judicial officers, I mean judges. I'm talking about Morse and Stevens, and I think others were involved as well.
Yantz,
yes. These are the individual. If you can hold an individual on $100,000 bail for nonviolent crimes that don't involve any property destruction, nonviolent actions that don't involve any property destruction, because businesses are so intent on making sure that this individual does not around outside in a public area, and that's the only thing they can think of, is keep threatening him with jail, hold him for 5 days, and then throw him into a long judicial process. And this wasn't the first, right? He has been through this process at least three times before, with being brought to the edge of trial, and then the charges were dropped.
This time
they didn't drop the charges, and they put on a George... what's his name? Shakostakovich?
George
Kovacevic.
Vampire Killer Kovacevic.
Kovacevic. That's the man who was judge for a short period of time. I guess he's out of the DA's office. And I observed him personally, and I tried not to be... I was prejudiced, of course, because I felt the whole charge was a bunch of crap. But I watched the way he proceeded in the trial to misrepresent what seemed to be even the testimony that was presented by prosecution and defense witnesses, simply to prejudice the jury. And I'd like to give a specific example if I can find one. It escapes me at the moment. It had to do with carefully shifting what was said to mischaracterize what Jerry Henry was doing. You know, did you enjoy coming and blocking the people from coming into the nobody testified he had. You know, I mean, it's interesting that anyway. So
arguments. I thought the most
we actually
most
have his
part was where he puts the names of these merchants up on this slideshow that he was doing, and said, "What's going to happen to these people if you don't convict Mr. Henry?" Well, what was going to happen to those people is that they probably would have had their day in court, in federal court, for the violation of the man's civil rights.
Yeah, it seemed to me to be a conspiracy to violate civil rights under color of law.
Oh, it's incredible. It's worst case. That I've experienced personally, witnessed. I know that there's been worse.
It's the kind of thing that they did in the South, and that you have the Ku Klux Klan Act to deal with, which involved Southern authorities trying to go after freed slaves by essentially legalizing terrorist activities by the Klan and other vigilante groups after the Civil War, but also just action by legal authorities, such as happened here, to tie up people in judicial proceedings that essentially involved criminalizing them and penalizing them for trying to simply be in public spaces.
They pitted the interest. It was so transparent. I mean, it's a matter of record now that the issues were the right of businesses to make a profit against the right of individuals to exist in a public place.
And, of course, in the adjacent courtroom, Robert Steffen, the man who is under the umbrella and often under the plastic bag, and I guess he's back on the mall, but he was moved away from Bunny's Shoes at that bench there where he had been sitting for the last 7 months, when, after an individual stole and ripped up his sign, police officer Brandt refused to take a police report and I guess the man, Robert Steffen, shouted, "Stop thief," and that was considered disturbing the peace.
Yeah.
And he was given a stay-away order from that part of the mall and told the only basis, the only legitimate behavior he could have and engage in, the only legitimate activity in that area would be to shop. So I think the folks are taking off the masks and taking off the gloves, and we get to see what the real bottom line here is.
Oh, yeah.
But I wasn't at the Jerry Henry faced a week's trial on, I guess it was eight, first 11, that's dropped down to 8, and then dropped down to 7 charges, essentially because he was in front of the Rancho Del Mar shopping center in Aptos, advising young people that they didn't have to move along when first alarm thugs told them to, and a whole bunch of charges were concocted by his being in the area and engaging in a petition to protest their behavior. So what happened at the end of the, the jury went out for how long, do you know?
The jury was out, Wednesday, Thursday, and then the Friday is when they came out, the end of the day on Friday, they came with their decision about 3:30.
And what was that decision?
Well, they found him guilty of two charges of disturbing the peace, and like I told you, one, intentional interference with a business, and that is such a bogus law that it'll fall.
So he was found guilty on 3 counts.
No, 4. And then there's another trespassing in a public place charge, which is also absurd. All of them, and the judge has pretty much indicated that he knows that they'll fall on appeal. The reason that they'll fall on appeal is because they went back, because of the underlying charge of the public nuisance allowed the district attorney to bring in stuff going back 4 years. So essentially what he was found guilty of was being demonized by the district attorney. So they had 4 years of demonization.
On the other hand, Richard, that did give the defense the opportunity to show 4 years of police harassment, but apparently the jury didn't buy the police harassment history. Did you know if anybody talked to the jury?
No, I don't know if anybody interviewed him. I certainly did. I didn't want to talk to him. There was only one person in there I'd have been interested in talking to, and that was the one that hung him on the conviction for the public nuisance.
And did anybody get that person's name?
No, but whoever he was, I'll tell you what, I think he realized that this was a step down a road that we don't want to go. It was the start of a slippery slope that nobody would be able to recover from.
Now, what was Jerry's sentence?
Well, that'll come up. That's the part that's going to be interesting, because Judge Kelsey is going to be handing that down, I think, on the 21st of July.
Uh-huh.
I think that was the date. I'm not certain. You'll have to check that.
Now, until then, is Henry still barred from the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center?
All of the previous conditions still exist. However, Kelsey did say to the district attorney, pointed out to him, that the restrictions post-sentencing are going to be substantially less than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he's done everything.
The restrictions he has now is he cannot go anywhere into the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center at all for fear that the sight of him would cause heart attacks among the sheriff's deputies and
or
various...
Or whatever. Yeah, right. I mean, you know, whatever stupid stories they
make. Now, what charges... You say he was found guilty of 2 acts of disturbing the peace. In what did those disturbing the peace incidents supposedly consist?
Again, I'm not really certain because I didn't see the charges as they were lined out in the complaint, so I don't know. But I do know that there were 2 incidents that happened in the second week in October, and they followed an incident which provoked them. It's kind of interesting, you know. One of the questions I asked one of the guys there at the little inspection station, because he's a regular deputy, I said, "What would happen if you got called out to somebody's house to complain about a barking dog? And you kept going out there, you know, and the dog would be barking, and then what you found out was that the dog only barked when the person who was calling and complaining did something like blow a whistle or something that would trigger the dog to bark, when normal circumstances would never bring that about. So you found that this barking dog was actually being provoked by the person that's doing the complaining. And he said that they'd probably go at the person that was making the dog bark.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is exactly the situation that happened in Jerry Henry's case. The incident where Jerry was provoked to the type of protest that he was making, a legitimate First Amendment protected protest to what had happened to him days earlier.
What was that?
If it's the incident, and I'm a little vague on it, but I believe what happened was that he and I were sitting there having a cup of coffee, calm and peaceful, and there'd been a period of probably 6 weeks where there'd been absolutely no demonstration of any kind by Jerry against his resentment toward the abuses that he had already suffered.
Which involved essentially being excluded from businesses
without
any good reason.
There was an area where he was not allowed to enter because the manager of a roasting company was having heart palpitations and sleepless nights, and it never occurred to him it could be the caffeine. It had to be the existence of Jerry Henry.
Mm-hmm.
That was the determination Stevens made when he issued the order. But anyway, he'd been calm for some extended period of time, and the security guard walks up and orders Jerry and I to get our stuff together and leave.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jerry was not involved in doing much about that, but I, of course, reared up and stomped my foot and told this idiot to get the hell out of there. And they ended up calling the police, and the police came up and took the security guards off to the side and talked to them. And then they came back over and said that the reason that we'd been ordered to leave is that somebody that looked like me had threatened this female security guard earlier in the day, but they knew it wasn't me. And Jerry's sitting back there, completely ignored, saying, well, then why was I ordered to leave if whoever it was looked like Quigley? And they weren't hearing that, but it was the song and dance that they gave us. And then, of course, the following day, I mean, the protest to the behavior started then.
And what kind of protests were there? Let's be candid. What do you mean by that?
Well, Jerry spoke out about what had happened to him, you know, being ordered to leave again, and began to renew his vocal protest.
Was this done in such a way as to make conducting business impossible?
No, it was done in such a way as to make the situation known. I mean, it's like your guy, Stefan, and hopefully they will group these appeals together, and they will appeal that decision.
Robert Stefan?
Yes, Stefan, I'm sorry,
mm-hmm.
Against Robert. They'll put those together with the Henry case and move up on the same thing all the way, because it's exactly the same situation, or similar enough that I say exactly the same. Nothing's exactly the same, or how
sure.
Would you know, but a very close situation.
But what kind of behavior was Jerry doing? Was he screaming for extended periods of time outside of business?
No. He would raise his voice on occasional moments when somebody would ask him about it. He would make comments about it. It's a little different from holding a sign. I mean, you're allowed in this country by the First Amendment to protest abuses against you, and he was exercising that right. Similar to this other guy, you know, where he was protesting the guy taking his sign and throwing it in the trash.
Right.
He made noise about it.
Right. Now, did he make noise 3 hours later? Did he make noise when it happened?
Yeah, a couple of days when it happened, and apparently a couple of days later, but only at the time when somebody came back up and started the same crap with him again. They've already got him lit up.
So he was again approached by either First Alarm or deputies,
and they
again told him to move or began to...
Would provoke him into... I mean, they'd sit there and poke at him until he started making noise, and then they'd run and make a police report on that. The incident that happened the day that started it did not end up in a police report at all, so there was no way to get that in the record.
But did you testify about that in court?
About that particular incident?
Right.
No.
See, that seems to me to be key, and it makes me realize, and I don't blame you for not testifying about it, you had a public defender who essentially spent 1 hour on the case until the very last weekend before this began to, you know, get, you know, reach. This is a very complicated, lengthy trial.
I'm not going to second guess her. I'm going to tell you my disappointment is a lot more in the jury than it is in the public defender. You know, a public defender, any defense counsel can only do so much.
It seems to me that that's a key piece of evidence, Richard, that an incident that is not recorded by police, it happens before the three days where all the actual so-called crimes occurred, and they involved disturbing the peace.
There's a history of those, and there's hundreds of those incidents in there, and it's like it's not possible for anybody to dedicate the time to going through all of that. And
this was the most recent incident. You said there had been a six-week period where nothing had happened. Then you said the situation came up where they misidentified him and they began this process of harassing him, right?
You can't get me to Monday morning quarterback that public defender and come up with anything bad against him.
I don't expect you to, Richard. I'm going to Monday morning quarterback.
Well, you go ahead and do that, and I think it's inappropriate. That young woman put her heart into that case, and I watched the disappointment on her when it came down, and I watched her take a lot more personal responsibility.
If she had taken a little heart about 2 weeks earlier, I would be saying exactly what you said. I'm sorry that I think that actually she'd done the preparation that she probably would have done for someone who wasn't an indigent client, or not indigent because Jerry's not indigent, but who is getting a public defender. I think there would have been a considerably different defense.
He is an indigent client, and so if the question is, do I think that the public defender's office is overloaded to the point that they are deemed ineffectual because of the time constraints on them? Yeah, hell yeah, man. When you're dealing with 30 cases a day, I mean, most attorneys don't have 30 cases a year. So, are they tied down by that? Are they restricted by that? Are they hurt by that? Yeah, it hurts the entire system for it to happen that way. Mm-hmm. You got the district attorney's office that's hiring more people and getting bigger and bigger budgets, and you got a public defender's office. Those attorneys in there are damn good lawyers. And they have a real, they got a real tough job because they got more to do than any human being could do.
I know. Okay,
within the confines of what that woman was given.
Let's agree to disagree. I'm going to disagree with you. I've spent as much time in the courts as you have. I come up with a different assessment, but okay. I can understand how you might feel otherwise. Continuing again with the Jerry Henry situation, you say he comes back for sentencing on the
21st, I think.
The 21st.
So I could be wrong about that.
Right. I will try to get more specific information as we approach that date. How is Jerry doing? How does he feel? Is he crushed? Is he optimistic? What's his situation?
His immediate reaction was upward and onward. I think that as it starts to sit in, that those 12 people couldn't get the truth out of what was put in front of them. And there was enough in front of them that there's no reason for them to have done what they did under normal circumstances, but they are misled. They do not understand how the deck is stacked, and so it's not uncommon for juries to come up with just ludicrous decisions against people on that basis.
What about the young people at Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center? The jury was he's often been called a street minister, advising about their rights. Are they? Do you have any reports on how they're being treated there at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center?
Oh, ever since Jerry's been banished, there's been a lot less harassment, although I can pretty much assure you the floodgates will open again now. I could see it as recently as a week ago. The optimism was up, and I was again ordered out of the shopping center. And that's not happened to me in well over a year.
What was your response to being... Tell us the circumstances of what happened.
A first alarm security guard, and they do believe that they're a privileged class, had parked directly in one of three regular patron parking places in front of the roasting company. There's only three of them, and she took one-third of all available parking directly in front of the roasting company. And a uniformed security guard from First Alarm pulled up in the space next to hers, which is, just happened to be an unofficial but nonetheless marked and used handicap place. Mm-hmm. And it's one that the people in the community, the disabled people in the community use because it's a wide space and it's good access and it's used all the time by the disabled. And so this second first alarm guard, a young man, pulled in there wearing his little uniform so that he could admire the car of this girl, this first alarm girl. And so I asked him if he would please, you know, move his car out of that handicap space. And the first thing she did was explain that it wasn't a handicap space because it didn't have the sign in front of it or whatever. And I said, "Miss, I'm not talking to you, but the fact is that this is, by custom and practice, a handicap space. And the people in this community are used to using it. And there's no reason for him to be parked there. And I'm simply asking him to move his car." And she, in informed him that he didn't have to listen to people like me, which I found an interesting reference. And I reminded her again that I wasn't talking to her and that she'd probably do well to mind her own goddamn business, and asked the young man again. And I was going through this polite phase because I hadn't tried it in a few years, and I thought I'd give it one more try.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, it didn't work. At that point, she ordered me out of the shopping center for loitering, and I told her to blow it out her backside. And not in those words. Again, I remained polite.
Mm-hmm.
But I politely told her I wasn't going anywhere.
When did this happen again?
Pardon?
When did this happen?
This is a week ago Friday.
So what time of day?
Probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Were there any witnesses?
Oh, yeah.
And what happened then?
Well, she called the sheriff's office, which I encouraged her to do, and when the deputy showed up, he had a little talk with her, and she went away.
What about the car and the handicap space?
He probably hung around there for another 3 to 5 minutes, and then he left. But it would have been a normal time for him to leave anyway. He just stopped by to admire her car.
Mm-hmm. Well, nothing wrong with admiring people's vehicles, of course.
I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a problem with the fact that as a shopping center employee, she wasn't parked in one of the shopping center parking places. And I have a problem with the fact that the roasting company only has those 3 customer places in front of their store. And, of course, it's okay with them because this is a special class of person. These security guards are the next best thing to a cop. And we all know in a police state that cops are superior to everyone else, you know, that whole line of thinking.
Which is as it should be.
Well, according, you know, and that's the sad part, because it wasn't just it's not just those merchants that see that. It was those people that sat on that jury.
Now,
otherwise, Mr. Henry would have never been convicted of anything.
When we began this conversation, you said that there was a case of your own coming up in 3 weeks. You want to talk about that? Or a case that you said would be significant.
No, that is going to be the day that...
The sentencing and appeal of Jerry...
Yeah, the sentencing.
I see. Okay.
Of Jerry Henry. That's the one that's coming up that's going to be significant, and I see it as just huge. I mean, I really do.
It's interesting.
I'm going to do everything I can to get permission to videotape that. The district attorney has... I see it as a warning, but he's certainly notified the court that the sheriff's office is going to come down to have something to say about the sentencing of Jerry Henry, and it, since the sheriff's office, this whole prosecution, this whole case, is a case to empower the sheriff's office to do these things to people and get away with it, it's going to be real interesting to be able to be there and record what it is that they have to tell the court about what should be done to this man. And if Kelsey's true to his word, which you and I both have evidenced, you know, sometimes he strays a bit, but if he's true to his word, it's not going to get him much. But I definitely want the record to be made on that, because it's going to be an impressive presentation, I promise.
Well, thank you, Richard. We've been talking to Richard Quigley, who's been a person very closely involved with doings at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center, and Jerry Henry, the street minister and local youth advocate who has been criminalized. That's the only word for it.
Yeah.
Barred from the shopping center, dragged through the judicial system, repeatedly jailed for the crime of essentially being in public spaces and saying things that sheriff's deputies first alarm. And it's not even the things he says and the business employees don't like, or business managers at the Gottschalks and Rancho Del Mar and Rancho Liquors Coffee Roasting Company. The apparently, it's also his appearance, the homeless appearance, the ragged appearance that, although it's not, I guess that was denied or glossed over by the prosecution. Anyway, I want to thank you for being with us on this. We're going to roll along and let some other folks call in with their thoughts on this. And
cool.
Thank you for calling in, Richard.
Anytime.
All righty.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Phone lines are now open on Bathrop Spears broadsides 427-3772. Actually, it's an interesting situation in court. Most oftentimes, judges will allow you to make recordings, audio recordings, for personal use only under the Section 980D of the California Rules of Court. For all you legal buffs, in case you want to do it, you get a form from the municipal court clerk. Fill it out, bring it down, give it to the bailiff, have your tape recorder ready. Although Kelsey, arrogant justice that he is, and justice, of course, is a misnomer here, judge, man in a black robe, patriarch of the court, doesn't even sign or affirm or deny these orders. He just sort of nods at you in a regal way. I find this very repugnant, and I've repeated this on the air before, but he has allowed audio recordings at the Henry trial. Admittedly, after there was a lot of, earlier on, a lot of threat of protest if these weren't allowed, and I was going to take it to the Commission on Judicial Performance. I had public defenders testifying that he was not even willing to sign yes or no to a court order and justify what he was doing. So there was a certain significant pressure on him about half a year ago when I brought this issue up to him. So he did allow audio recordings. Audio recordings, however, under that section, 980D of the California Code, does not allow you to play them publicly. However, we are lucky in that Joel Coppa and his co-worker Becky Johnson were granted the right to video the closing arguments and to get the audio with the video. We weren't able to get the video. We do have the audio for the closing arguments. It is finally, again, the prosecution, that person has a chance to speak twice, makes. And the rationale for the prosecution being allowed two shots of the jury and the defense getting only one is that the prosecution has to prove things, quote, beyond a reasonable doubt. Of course, what the reality is, it's below a tenable budget is what the reality is for the public defender. For the prosecution, of course, it's whatever the hell they want to do whenever they want to do it, and it's sort of a sad situation for our justice system. I've never seen a comparison about prosecution and defense budgets, and I'd like to say that, I mean see that, so I can actually make some intelligent arguments about it. But I've heard a lot about overburdened public defenders. I wonder if the same argument is applicable to the public, to the prosecutor's office in terms of resources. I made the charge that they're getting more financial backing for their resources. I don't know if that's true. And I take it back until I do more research on it. It certainly seems we don't hear a lot of complaints about from the prosecution, I haven't anyway, that they don't have the resources and so forth. Rather, we hear from the public defender's office, because then says they defend everybody. And the prosecution, essentially, in its prosecution, doesn't have to go to trial. It just threatens and does these plea bargains, which is, of course, the way our rights are sold down the river in the local courts regularly for about 95% of the cases. Let's see if we can hear a little of the Jerry Henry closing arguments. We may give it up shortly because the quality is too bad, but let's see what we can do here.
Okay, and it's June 27th, the Jerry Henry trial, and they're going to have closing arguments soon.
And I'm going to emphasize again, this is not a tape made under 980D. This is a tape made granted where the media was granted media access, actually even video access. So this is completely illegal on a playment of a tape on a radio station which doesn't even have a license. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. But in these matters, I try to be very fastidious because I do record regularly in court and I follow their rules so that they will allow me to continue to record regularly. Just the public defender and the private prosecutor making his argument coming up. George Cavazos.
Anything else that you want to write?
Yes, I did want to raise my objections to jury instructions as to pre-sentence. I feel that those instructions...
Actually, I think what we're going to do here, since it appears there's a tape doesn't begin with the actual arguments, I'm going to do a little better cueing. And before I do that, I'm going to finish off the issue of the sleeping ban, the late night session, my arrest, what actually got passed, and then I'm going to play you an interview with Fred Geiger on living wage and some other items, including the sleeping ban. And while that is all happening, bear with me, if you will. I know this sounds a little tangled. I'm going to try to make sure so we get some really decent audible quotes from Jerry Henry. In other words, this is all an excuse for me to do a little working in the studio that I should have done beforehand. But hey, it's my show, and you're stuck with it. It is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, 96.3 FM. Again, to finish off what happened at the council meeting as they finished off the safe sleeping zones, Christopher Crone at 1:15 at night brought his resolution, which was supposed to come up in the afternoon, was added late. The resolution was to, it had four parts. Get the National Guard Armory at De La Vega Park, and that motion carried to direct staff to redouble efforts. I'm reading from the actual action agenda, which is what was published by the City Council a day later. They tell you what they did at City Council meetings. The motion carried to direct staff to redouble efforts in procuring safe and secure shelter for the homeless at the National Guard Armory at De La Vega Park, and to include sending an emissary to proper state legislators, such as a local meeting at the offices of Fred Keeley and Bruce McPherson, to bring the city's specific concerns, including any kind of policies or protocols that people have accepted on this matter and that the city hopes to change. And what this gobbledygook means is that the head of the armory, the military man running it, said, no way, forget it. He put the kibosh on the year-round use of the armory. The only time the armory could be used, apparently, it will begin in November again when it's customarily used. So this is fundamentally, let's go complain to the state legislature, but there's no indication this is going to open up any shelter. And the real proposals for shelter that might have come up, such as lifting the sleeping ban in certain areas of the city, such as opening up a campground either in the Poganip or in the lower De La Vega Park, which is not where the armory is, but what is significantly below it, proposed by Michael Hernandez, many feel as an election eve kind of deal, which had nothing to do with a real proposal, since he's had 4 years to make a real proposal and has never done so, never attended one homeless issues task force meeting, never attended one task force to examine the camping ordinance meeting, never spoken on the issue in any length at all at City Council. It's just sort of suddenly, here he is in the middle of an election contest, and he wants to do something. And he did this. Now, he has returned a couple of my phone calls. I would love for Michael to prove me wrong, and perhaps my producer can try to get Michael Hernandez on the phone and invite him to call into the show. He's welcome to be on the air on Free Radio and talk about this issue. I frequently criticize him, although I also give him credit, and I gave him credit for what he did early Wednesday morning at that council meeting last week, which was he asked that not a campground, that didn't come up, but the issue of a large building on the west side near Safeway, which is vacant and apparently up for sale, and it's set back from residences, has a large parking lot, could be used immediately for shelter and for a parking area. And this was dismissed by his confreres and consoeurs, Hernandez, the folks who often vote with him, Matthews and Rotkin. So that was the first thing, this motion carried to send a bunch of people out on a useless mission. That's fine. The second motion was to direct staff to work with the Homeless Resource Center and come back with a proposal for an ongoing program to identify other suitable sites to house the homeless which are not on city streets nor sidewalks. This has been done for years. It started back in 1995. No, actually, it started back in 1990. I'm sure it started before then, but there's a whole history of task forces ranging from the 1995-96 Celia Scott, Catherine Byers, Find a New Campground group that was looking for that campground, to the commission to the task force to end the examine the camping ordinance of 1998-99, which Catherine Byers led around in a merry-go-round before she said, no, we're not going to do anything. And finally, the most recent year-long homeless issues task force, $10,000 staffed by Catherine Byers' close pal Don Lane, old anti-homeless downtown association groupie Don Lane, who got his $10,000 out of this, or his $5,000-$6,000 out of this nice job, but nothing happened. I mean, the homeless issues task force actually did, it took action demanding an end to the camping ordinance, period, and it took that action very early, and it demanded safe sleeping zones early, and it made some other demands in spite of Don Lane, who didn't convey these things effectively to City Council, was considered to have been often blocking them. He's the final report under his guidance omitted numbers of key things, but in any case, all these issues had come up before. So the second thing was a motion to get this motion that came up on June 27th, 28th, the Crone motion, to work with the Homeless Resource Center and come back with a proposal. First of all, the Homeless Resource Center is overburdened, and this was pointed out by Hernandez, again, who said some good things. Ironically, it was Hernandez who was saying the good things, that the Homeless Resource Center, it isn't the person that should do this, it's the staff, it's Dick Wilson, it's the same guy who's refusing to put, the city manager is refusing to put dumpsters and porta-potties out in the affected zones. But Mike Rotkin said, no, we don't want that, that's not necessary. So they sent it all back to Ken Cole, who is getting increasingly conservative under pressure from his board, and apparently now will not allow, for example, the Karen Brock's name to be mentioned as a distribution point for ROAR, Restore Our American Rights flyers. That's the campers group that meets today, by the way, for those of you who are interested, 4:30 in the afternoon at Harvey West Boulevard and Dubois Street, up there at the Harvey West Park area, so in case you're interested in that. I'm telling you what happened at the city council meeting, what resolutions were passed. First, they sent out these go to the legislators and try to open up the armory, even though they're not going to do it. That's the first thing. Secondly, don't ask the Homeless Service Center to find some places, even though there are all kinds of places found, and the city council is refusing to act on them. Now we have a quick call here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
I'm good. You're listening to the show there, Doug?
Yeah.
Before you talk, let me quickly summarize. I've never been able to get through this. I'm going to just give you the last two items that happened in the evening on the city council agenda. Thanks. I feel like I start this and I never finish it. The third one was was a motion that passed to withdraw publication of the Safe Sleeping Zones Amendment to Ordinance 2010, amending 6.36 of the Santa Cruz Municipal Code to authorize overnight sleeping on public property or in vehicles on public streets in those areas of the city zoned for industrial use, and to direct in a public statement that police continue the council's previous policy of complaint-based response to violations of the camping ordinance. Now, this was originally just going to be put off till July 11th, but buyers moved immediately to have it withdrawn, in essence killed, and Rotkin added the provision about having the police complaint-only process put on the record, which actually might be an in for some of us, though Rotkin's collusion with the police is well known. He said that the police only ticket on the basis of complaint anyway, which I find not to have been the case, because at least three-quarters of the tickets I get, or the move-along reports from campers by police, did not have, they ask, was there a complaint, and the police say no. It's illegal what you're doing. Finally, the fourth thing passed by the city council was a motion carried to table the placement of a ballot measure until the July 11th or 25th council agenda regarding the amendment to the city's camping ban and notify all interested persons and agencies of this pending action. What that means is the Silva resolution to end the sleeping ban in some parts of the city and the city council's May 23rd resolution to allow specific safe sleeping zones smaller than the Silva initiative will be put on the ballot. Now, actually, buyers wanted to end this too, but Rotkin, for his own reasons, wanted to keep it because I think he sees it as a way of getting out conservative voters for the district election issue and getting his faction back in power. That's my analysis. Thank you for your patience, Doug, in letting me go through this whole rigmarole. This is what happened at the city council meeting. I'll talk about my arrest soon, but you're calling in about something else, and I'm arrested already, so arrest me. Go ahead.
Oh, actually, this is a public service announcement, and specifically for the poor and the homeless.
Well, we don't want their kind around here, man.
It has to do with a free meal. The Festa of the Portuguese Hall, and they serve a luncheon today for the public, and it's at the Portuguese Hall down there in Harvey West.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a vegetarian meal.
Uh-oh.
It's, cooked cow.
Uh-oh, dead cow, man.
A lot of dead cow, and some, it's called sopa bread, and cabbage, and then there's these little beans called fava beans.
What time is this recast?
Lupini beans, I'm sorry.
Lupini.
It's actually going on right. If they start serving at 11, then at 12 o'clock the parade comes back from Mass and everything up at the church. They go across the bridge over the highway and then down a little bike path to the Portuguese Hall there at Harvey West.
Hmm.
And then they continue serving again until basically everybody's been through.
Wow, and so this is open to the public, even the poor and hungry. Huh?
Absolutely.
Wow, so you don't have to be a Harvey West merchant or a Texas Instruments employee.
No. Don't even have to be Portuguese.
You know, Doug, you've been attending these ROAR meetings. Are these ROARers going to roar, or are they going to squeak? What's your analysis? That's the Restore American Rights, the campers group that's going to be meeting at 4:30 this afternoon up at Harvey West and Dubois Street.
I'm not real sure. Basically, I'm in it to see if the homeless want to themselves create their own group,
mm-hmm.
and start, creating community group together, as the people did down in the flats of the Dolphin League. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's really more powerful than anything. A community together, and, you know, what they've tried to do is split everybody up all the time with this and saying, okay, we find syringes, we find bottles, you know. You know, the drunks don't like junkies, the junkies don't like speed freaks, the speed freaks don't like crazy people, and it goes on and on, and none of them like the rich people that live in Winnebagoes, and it, you know, no one likes anyone. And I think that a community, a strong community of homeless and transitional people, you know, a lot of, with some good ideas, is better than anything, is more powerful than the sword.
Well, you know, I know you were involved a lot with the Homeless Issues Task Force, the group that met for, what, 8 or 9 months, and I guess we still have yet to hear when the Homeless Issues Task Force's final recommendations are going to actually be examined in a public one-by-one fashion. That was supposed to happen on the 13th.
Thousands of dollars, thousands of hours, a lot of hard work. But one day, if they keep having enough task force and a few million dollars later, they might have one that maybe says what they want to hear.
Yeah, right. I think, of course, what we need to know is what came out of that task force that was important. And I think at some point I'd love to have you on the air to talk about, regardless of what the city does or doesn't do about it, what you think that did come out of that task force that we should pay attention to, and what perhaps we, you know, I don't think we have to bother what we need to ignore, since it's being ignored anyway. But at some point, I'd like to have you talk about that.
Sure.
The other thing is, I'm going to be talking later in this program about reports of increased harassment of people in vehicles. Have you gotten any of those reports, or people who are outside sleeping or just trying to live, you know, be in a public space without being stigmatized and scapegoated for it? Anything new on that front?
Sure. Everyone's having a major problem. No one knows where to go. You know, it's very frustrating. It adds a lot of fear and anger to the problem, and you know it's still not a solution. And you know, I don't know what kind of reverb you get back from this. It's a tough situation. You know,
have you had any specific complaints or specific contacts that have been brought to your attention?
Well, sure. You know, I like some of the homeless are even employed, and one lady was given by Officer Seeley, you know, was given an hour to move her trailer, which she parks in the industrial zone where it was supposed to be safe while she works, you know. You know, they can unhook it. Of course, once you, even if it's hooked to your car, once you, like, put down the tongue to level it, you know, it's always considered wrong. You have to move it. And she's at work. He gave her an hour. You know, she had to leave work to move it if that was meant to, you know, they're making it very difficult.
Now, Officer Seeley is one of the one or two probable new police positions that were created, I believe, under deceptive circumstances by the city council in expectation of there being, you know, these safe sleeping zones that would require increased policing. Now that the safe sleeping zones have been killed, at least for the moment, you've got the extra police officers, and gosh, they have nothing to police. I wonder what they're going to do.
I don't know. The first deception is that he has the ability to be, or has the capability to be as considerate as his father.
You're talking
and
about
it goes
Officer
on
Seeley.
From then. Right. The elderly Officer Seeley had just retired.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I don't know. He's been involved in so much things over the years.
Well, I know he was famous for ordering you out of your lodgings at the Homeless Services Center a year ago when you were having a dispute with Karen Gillette, stating you have no rights, and I guess you filed a complaint with the Citizens Police Review Board about that, right?
Right. The complaint didn't fly, but everything else flew, and they knew that they were wrong. But, you know, the Citizens Police Review Board is a waste of time and money, too.
Speaking of which, by the way, I kind of began to talk about that earlier. Citizens Police Review Board, of course, will be meeting the second Monday of the month at 5:30 at the, I guess, the City Council chambers. But you may recall that I was talking about a Brown Act violations earlier in this show. I don't know if you were listening. And one of the really key and documented Brown Act violations of the City Council was to try to hold a meeting from which they tried to exclude the public, which was essentially a subcommittee of the City Council and a subcommittee of the Citizens Police Review Board, in which they were going to talk about strengthening the law for the Police Review Board. And they held this meeting in the City Manager's office. I came to it, and again, Bob Aronson, their $10,000 Palo Alto attorney consultant who they hired to help with this new police review board ordinance reexamination, said that the city attorney Barisoni's opinion that they could hold this meeting without violating the Brown Act was wrong, that they had to make it an open meeting, and they didn't, and since that time they've held no meetings to discuss any real reforms. Well, that apparently is coming to an end. They have finally decided to hold another meeting. They're going to hold another meeting on July 17th at 5:30 in the Civic Auditorium ABC Room on the issue of policies and procedures, the Citizens Police Review Board, and the development of recommendations for changes to the process, including but not limited to such issues as public disclosure, independent reviews, timeliness of complaint investigations, and the handling of frivolous complaints. So you're supposed to get your comments in by July 10th to the CPRB office if you're interested, or you can email them to cprb@cia.santa-cruz.ca.us. Gary Yamani, by the way, has announced he's leaving. So the only person with any continuity on the CPRB who's not a member of the board but who's their main staff member will be leaving probably as of August. So you'll have a new person in there. Perhaps, Doug, you should apply for the post.
Hmm. Yeah, they'll probably put Officer, what's his name, the guy that's an investigator in there now.
Oh, Lee Sepulveda.
Yeah, Lee Sepulveda.
That would be kind of a...
But, you know, I think actually on the police, Citizens Police Review Board should just forget the one that they have operated by the city. And citizens group themselves should create, finance, and make one themselves, and have maybe, you know, we with a couple of lawyers involved that put in suits against real actions, real complaints. Every time they consider complaints true, and take them through the court, and forget a city-sponsored police review board, because that's absurd and a waste of my money and time.
So far,
I've been there with the facts, I mean, and everything, with it written out, you know, by, and they just, and they even listen to you, because they listen only to the facts that the police investigator, they give his conclusion as their conclusion.
Frequently the case, in fact, almost invariably the case, and I know that even their written announcements to people about their cases coming up for closed review don't tell the people that they have the option to appear before the board and present their own evidence before it goes into closed session. And I've repeatedly told them that this is a way of making sure the public is denied a real process, since the police have an elaborate paid process and access to paid staff, whereas the public now is not even told that they can present evidence to the police review board before it goes into closed session, which they can. Not that it would make any difference, but it's just another example. Doug, I hope to see you today at 4:30 if you're going to show at the Restore Our American Rights Roar meeting out at the Harvey West Park. And I'm also thinking that it's time to get back on the ball with Julie Pulliam and other attorneys who are hopefully going to help some kind of civil rights lawsuit that could parallel protests this summer. I know David Silva and others have been working on their initiative still, although I think that's pretty much a lost cause. It's pretty late in the game for the initiative. It has to, I guess, be... It could be put on the ballot by a resolution by the city council, but the question then would arise, do we want to have the sleeping ban on the ballot when we don't have any organization in place to counter the massive bigoted propaganda that the business owners are going to put out against it? What do you think?
If nothing else, like, great. You know, there has to be... Someone like the Green Party is going to have to finance a real campaign, you know, prior to the election, just as, you know, like you would a regular campaign candidate. And it's going to have to go on the ballot like in the truth. I don't really think that the opposition will campaign against it, but I think they'll just do it on, you know, through emails and the media, you know, the newspaper type.
I think you'll get the same kind of crap you get today's Sunday Sentinel, which shows a, you know, Sugar Crone and Fitzmaurice playing pinball with the dirty camping machine and the hypodermic needles. And I mean, I think there would be a widespread advertising campaign to get. They would use the sleeping ban to get people to the polls to vote down district, vote up district elections, which is what they want because they think they can get more conservatives in power through the district election process. Not that the people who are in power now are any are that much better than the people that, you know, than the so-called honest conservatives. Anything else you want to say? I appreciate your letting me kind of wind you through this series of topics. Anything you want to talk about?
Oh, no, that was it. I'm not going to be able to make the meeting. We have people in from out of town because Marilyn's family is Portuguese. I just wanted to reiterate that there's a free meal down for anyone that would like to go. Go ahead. Everything's cool. And the Portuguese Hall. And good talking to you. And I guess we just keep on going, Robert.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Keep on trucking. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is your man about dials and switches, Robert Norris, here at Free Radio. Finally, again, winding up the evening. Boy, it seems to take me forever to do this on Wednesday evening after the city council meeting where they voted down the safe sleeping zones. I guess there's some aftermath that we should talk about on this, too. The fact that this vote was taken and that it's coming up again on July 11th, not by council action. There's not going to be any proposed reexamination of the safe sleeping zones, but the question of whether they should be on the ballot and whether it's the sleeping ban itself should be on the ballot, the sleeping sections of the camping ordinance, will be coming up for consideration at the July 11th council meeting, which means these meetings are an appropriate place to really get to the nitty-gritty, which is not the political contortions around this stuff, but the real needs people have outside of legal places to sleep, not being harassed, a real review process when their police officers are harassing them, as they apparently have been. I have a report here from a woman named Brandon, and she didn't suggest I keep her name in confidence. She was parked on the highway just past the city limits. This report was, I guess, phoned into me on Friday, I believe it was. Might have been yesterday. It was either yesterday or the day before. She was just past the city limits because the cops, Santa Cruz police, had run everyone out of town. They ticketed her husband. Sheriff's deputies came by and ticketed her husband. They were in two vehicles. They were in a trailer and a car. One sheriff approached her vehicle between 11:30 p.m. and midnight. The motorhome was apparently both of them were in the motorhome. Her vehicle, which was in front of the, which was a separate vehicle from the motorhome, was locked or was closed. Sheriff wanted to search both of them for what? She said. She said, "Well," said the husband had a search clause. He said, "Yes, you can search. You know, under protest, you can search his surroundings because he's inside the motorhome, as I understand this correctly. But you can't search my vehicle." In retaliation, the sheriff trashed the motorhome in a search and ticketed them. He threw everything on the floor. There was a baby in the motorhome. She said, "You can search it if you don't wake up the baby." He did so in a fashion that was apparently not too fastidious in that regard. This is a couple. I guess the husband was busted with 12 pounds of pot some years ago, but he wasn't on parole. It was all supposed to be over. And there's a claim that if you don't register every 5 months as a drug offender, you're going to be arrested. And so the sheriff said he would give them a break by not checking the license. He threatened to bring a drug dog on duty. Brandon said, "Bring him over. We got nothing to hide. We don't do drugs. Quit accusing us. We've been here for 4 years. This woman works two jobs. She gave me the names of the businesses. I'm not going to refer to them right now unless I get her permission to do so. Husband works for himself, does hauling, cleans construction sites." And I learned a lot more about the history of police harassment from her in terms of specific details. They had been staying around the west side up Highway 1. They move regularly every 2 or 3 days. They've been moving every single day recently. They noted people have been much ruder. A woman comes by in the morning, when this was before they killed the safe sleeping zones, and said, "Wake up, get out of here," when they were parked on Delaware. She replied to her, "Go home, worry about your own damn family," or her husband did. "They do their own thing, they work, and they go to bed. And they've gotten only one ticket in two or three years. This, I guess, is the second. So here's an example of someone who now wants to join ROAR. I'm hoping that she will show up at the campers meeting today. And I hope others will, too. That's going to be, again, at 4:30 at Harvey West Park at Du Bois and Harvey West Boulevard, 4:30 today. And there's also a phone number, which... actually the phone number of Doug, the guy who just called in, his voicemail And I unfortunately don't have that handy at the moment. But if you are going to call in, if you call 423-HUFF, 423-4833, I will pass on any messages directly to him, and I pick up my messages usually within hours. So do give a call to 423-4833. If you are a person who's been having problems with the police, or you're interested in ROAR, Restore Our American Rights, or if you're interested in HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, this is a sort of a longer, long-term organization that's been around, concerned with numbers of civil rights issues around homeless people, not the least of which is the sleeping ban. 423-HUFF is the number to call for that. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, of course, at 96.3 FM, so-called Freak Radio. Call-in lines are open to the studio, 427-3772, voicemail 427-4523. You want to send loops, CDs, news, money, demos, attractive sexual partners, Post Office Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's my addition, of course. Webpage is www.microradio.net/FRSC, email frsc@microradio.net. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. How you doing?
Hey, sounds like battling Bob LaMonica.
Robert, what country club are you a member of?
Well, I don't think I'm a member of any particular country club except the Club of Hard Knockaroonies.
So you're not a member of the Paso Tiempo Country Club?
I have not, although the city supports that and repairs their golf courses regularly, no, I'm not.
The Pajaro Valley Golf Club?
I haven't yet joined the Pajaro Valley Golf Club, no.
So what are we left with? How do you expect to achieve any power without rubbing elbows with the right people?
Well, it's
finding
a very,
out what they want.
That's a very good question, Bob. I may have to marry into the clan, and perhaps I'll do that at some point. But actually, I don't believe in marriage either, so I think I'm really in trouble.
Did you see page A10 of Friday's Sentinel?
If I did, I've forgotten it. Remind me.
Well, on page A10, there is a request for written comments, public notice. And it's very historical because this is a request for written comments, and it also is a public notice regarding the Monday, July 17th meeting of the Citizens Police Review Board and City Council.
All right. I think I just mentioned that because I received a letter, but yeah, go ahead.
This is your work, Robert, in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of those that are aware of what went down, there was an attempt to have a closed meeting to review the Citizens Police Review Board.
Mm-hmm.
When was that? Back in October or something?
It was, I think, in February or March.
Of what?
Of this year.
No. Was it that late, really?
Yeah, actually what happened was they hired this Bob Aronson. This,
yeah, I came in late to the meeting. I remember that meeting.
Right. It was held in the city manager's office. I kept telling them, you can't have a meeting of this sort. It violates the Brown Act, which requires that it be noticed, that it have, you know, be open to the public, that it have public comment sections. And Keith Sugar, made some kind of secondary discussion through City Clerk Leslie Cook that maybe he'd open it up, but then he decided not to. Then when he showed up and he saw the four people there, not just me, including, I guess, eventually you, suddenly it was going to be an open meeting. But, of course, you cannot suddenly declare an open meeting if it hasn't been noticed. I mean, you can declare it open, but it's not a Brown Act.
This is
a 72-hour advance notice.
What's in Friday's Sentinel is an acknowledgment of acquiescence.
Right. Well, what happened was, of course, I mean, well, they quite right.
This is a public notice.
Right,
about an acknowledged now public meeting.
Right. Of course, the reality, though, is they have delayed this process for 4 or 5 months.
But of course, now we're getting right near to where the November 2000 elections take off, and they're beginning to take off already. It's all very predictable, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
These are all very, very easy to interpret stall tactics, one after another, after another, after another. But this is interesting that it is an acquiescence to open this process up. This meeting will be, I think, will be very interesting. Monday, July 17th, 5:30 at the Civic Auditorium ABC Room,
mm-hmm.
and to see where it goes and where it doesn't go. And I heard on your show that Gary Yamani is now retiring from his position.
That's what he told me, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't see any hope for the Police Review Board because it was never intended to have it do anything but give an appearance of investigation. It was a fraud. It was set up to be a fraud.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid you're right. It was set up by Kennedy and Byers. They were the people who put it forward. Actually, Kennedy was the one who essentially defanged it. But even the powers it has, it is never really used. And that's the sad thing.
one of the board members said he would leak the independent closed investigation if it weren't made public. Well, I'm still waiting for him to, or her to leak it, whichever one it was, and her or him, at that, you know, whenever that happens. And of course it hasn't happened. And so we have individuals who use the CPRB and other commissions as stepping stones to political power, such as Michael Hernandez used the CPRB to get into the city council. It's simply become a political football to use, a political stool to step on.
Well, if you're going to do something, it should be done with some degree of merit. And I think that one can look at the Police Review Board. How long has it been in existence?
Since 1995.
95. 5 years, and there has not been one public investigation.
There has not been one public hearing.
Well, not one public hearing.
There was one independent investigation which has been closed. So
that
it's not,
was the
it's
Dine
not public.
Matter?
No, Dine never got a public investigation.
Okay.
It was the the May 22nd police riot against the homeless. Riot is a little strong, although I suppose not that strong. Not against the homeless, against the protesters, some of whom were homeless, but many of whom were not, at the Yugoslavian, the Democratic Party fundraiser at the McPherson Center on Front Street. So yeah, they have not used those opportunities, the sad thing, as I said, even though I constantly castigate Gary Yamane, he is the only one who has a sense of the history of this body. When he's gone, I don't think anybody's going to remember what's going on.
Isn't that what's wanted?
Yeah.
And Yamane probably got tired of the snow job.
I would hope so. I told him, that he was getting, he's essentially, looting the public trough. I mean, not because he's a bad guy, but because his board isn't doing anything, and it's giving a fig leaf to the police department. Let me ask you a question, though, Bob, because you were quite instrumental in helping put together the sleeping ban repeal initiative back in 1998, 99. There was a more substantial initiative that we were trying to put on the ballot that decriminalized sleeping and covering up with blankets in non-residential, non-beachfront parts of town. And then I guess the second time around, when David Silva reintroduced that this year, it also excluded downtown areas and residential areas inside the industrial zone, so an even smaller area. And now, I guess, what's come back to City Council, they killed the safe zones, but coming back on the 11th is the question of putting on the ballot the tiny safe zones that they had proposed, which were even smaller than Silva's second initiative, and also the possibility of just simply eliminating the sleeping ban citywide as a sort of a separate question. This was worked out in a kind of a behind closed doors between Silva and the scan party politicians, Ms. Sugar Fitzmaurice and Byers, I guess, were the ones who were there, and they agreed to this. Silva essentially agreed to dump the safe zones if they would do the sleeping ban repeal on the ballot. I think David had good motives. He felt the safe zones were going nowhere. They were getting increasingly condensed and restricted by the police department and bogus CEQA appeals under the environmental law, and staff refusal to put out porta potties and dumpsters. It was all becoming quite clear that this was not a good faith effort to really try the safe zones, see how they worked. But what is coming up on the 11th is a proposal to have this on the ballot, the sleeping ban repeal and the safe zones. Is this a good idea? What do you think?
It's better to than to not, in the sense that these kinds of things push the envelope. And it will be interesting to see how the dividing lines fall, who speaks out and who doesn't, how they speak out. And I feel very similarly to other provocative issues. Rent control should be on the ballot. If the council had the courage that they claim behind the scenes, if they really had the principle to which they claim to be about, there is certainly majority support in principle for a rent control measure on the November 2000 ballot. So to me, I would not be afraid of this issue or any issue that one believes in giving a ballot opportunity, even if it fails, because these things push the envelope. We're in very interesting times, the basic issues, what's been going on earlier with your show regarding police state potentiality and manifestation, are some of the more interesting issues of our time. And I think that it would be interesting to see this kind of stuff hit the ballot. My sense is the sleeping ban should be removed. It has no business being a law. It should have never been a law. It was a mistake. Anyone that reads the first three lines of the sleeping ban should be appalled that it's on paper. There's no need for it. I think what it gets down to is, do people have the right to exist outdoors? Do people have the right to be homeless? And if we say yes, well, then there has to be some kind of a mechanism of tolerance. If we say no, well, then let's say police state. Let's just get it over with.
Well, also, I mean, it sounds to me like, of course, it's not even a question. Some people like to frame it as a lifestyle choice. But when you talk to 95% of the people, you find it is simply an economic reality of our times, given what you know, Bob, because you've been pushing for rent control for some time and were responsible for pressing for that initiative last fall. There is an economic reality that most people just don't have other choices than to live in vehicles or that is forced to live outside, not just here but in other parts of the country as well. And it's important to acknowledge this and understand this and to distinguish it from this bogus debate, which to me just sounds like sort of bigotry dressed out in other clothing. When they talk about the, we've got these hippies, rainbow types that just love to be outside and travel around. It is true that some people do that, and I don't think we should fault them for it unless they're violating real laws.
Well,
you know?
Yes, and that's the essence. Trespassing, disturbing the peace,
sure.
Littering, these are valid laws,
sure.
Valid ordinances. You do not need an ordinance, a law, which is an abuse of power, the sleeping ban.
Right.
That says that you cannot sleep outdoors from 11 to 8:30 or whatever the time is.
And since everybody...
It's patently absurd.
Since everybody has to sleep, it means the police officer comes across you during those hours. She or he will have absolute power to interrogate you, to search you, to question you, to intimidate you, to get you to move on.
And this is back to the Jerry Henry thing. These are the way these things do begin. Okay? But yeah, you bet. And to say that, well, it's a tool that the police officers need, not necessarily. We can make anything to justify that. There's enough stuff, enough principles on paper where to make poverty a criminal act, which is what this does. It's to me, it can be articulated, and it can be articulated around the sensationalism. And that way, they're very similar to rent control. Rent control is this claim of it's against free enterprise. Well, look, private property would not exist without public law. We regulate most things because it's shown that the unbridled market becomes inhumane. And to say that we can't do it with housing, and that we must do it with housing on the central coast of California, I think it's easy to argue. These things need the opportunity to get above board, and to have people articulate the issues, I think, in what are understandable terms. Are we willing in Santa Cruz to make poverty a crime in the year 2000? So I say, put this issue on the ballot. Don't be afraid of it. Let's see how things break left and right.
So you don't think that the fact that there'll be a huge economic differential in terms of the amount of money that's spent on this campaign? I don't see scam.
Yes, there will. And the same thing is said with rent control, Robert. But look, we're talking about the truth here. If we are talking about the truth, and we're talking about things like courage and honor and principle, then it should not matter. It should not essentially matter. And then what you can do, what you can say at the end of the day is that you did the right thing.
And it's also true, I guess, that we're not voting for an initiative that's going to lock in place the sleeping ban. This would be an initiative that would try to change it. If it's voted down, that doesn't prevent the next city council from making a move to do it anyway.
Of course.
And
that's where I think a lot of these things, you look over the last couple of years and how one issue after another has been spun out, strung out, through task forces and through proceduralism, to where really nothing has been done. What was done with the sleeping ban, reducing the fee by one quarter or whatever it was token.
It was reduced.
Predictable.
It was reduced to a third of what it was, but still $54 is not something people can afford.
It was a predictable, well, look, this is what we did.
Right.
Well, if it's true, is the bottom line that this law in its existence is corruption? If we can get to that step, then the next thing is it has to be removed.
Right. Well, I appreciate that, Bob. I also got, I guess, one final question for you, because we're going to be listening to an interview with one of your old pals, Fred Geiger. Actually, not an old pal of yours, perhaps, but a central person in an organization you've been quite critical of, SCAN, Santa Cruz Action Network. One of the issues that came up at the last city council meeting was medical marijuana. I noticed in today's Sentinel, you read today's Sentinel, I'm sure,
yes.
That they describe that the council changed the nature of that law that was passed, which did initially only require that you go to a doctor for a certain condition, which could conceivably be helped by marijuana. Now it requires the doctor actively recommend the marijuana. Is that your understanding of that situation?
I don't think that's bad. I think that if we're going to use medical marijuana as a wedge.
Well, I'm not asking if it's bad. Is it accurate? I mean, do you think that actually reflects what happened?
A doctor has to prescribe medicinal marijuana for a potential patient.
He simply can't certify that condition exists.
No, I don't think it's ever been that way, Robert.
Well, see, that's what I understood that was the case back in April when they passed the law, and that they've tightened it up.
You have to get the ongoing premise from the beginning of 215 was a doctor's prescription for medical marijuana.
I thought there was a medical condition. I thought it was a medical condition because doctors have a great trouble, you know, they get put on a blacklist immediately when they start those kinds of prescriptions. You know, you got very few doctors who are willing to do that.
Yeah, but they're getting more, you know, as the numbers build, it boils down to a doctor's prescription. And as time passes and these things have to get tighter as they become more above board procedurally, just like what you're saying about being able to tape court hearings. If you follow the procedures, they can't call you to account.
Right, but this is the procedures. The procedures should be, I think, that it's...
You have a condition?
And you just have a condition. And again, if the condition, that you know, the doctor doesn't have to certify that you don't need marijuana, just that you have the condition.
If marijuana is a medicine, then what this says is that it's a prescription. It can be prescribed.
I want to thank you, Bob, for calling me. I'm gonna run on you because I'm going to roll the next
ask
call.
Ask Fred Geiger about rent control, Santa Cruz, in the year 2000.
That actually isn't on the tape, and I don't have him live, but you certainly can call in and comment on that after this is over.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, see ya.
Bye-bye.
And phone lines are again open at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3. The phone line is 427-3772.